Thanks, Trav. And I don't know about you, but my head is spinning after all of that. Bravo, Mariana. As a way of organising the conversation, I mean, there are two particular things that you're talking about. One of them is about ideas and how you change the framework in which we think about them. And the other one is the institutions you need to do that. And I suppose I'd like to start with that the idea about the idea, about how you rethink the contract, and that idea of missions, because that seems to me a really clever way of, you know, because we can all talk about all of these things. But is that realistically the only way you can sort of start to sort of force the institutional change, that you say to somebody, okay, we're going to go for a specific goal and we're going to organise around that? And is that because the sort of institutional forces, the intellectual arguments are so deeply entrenched in the way we think about the public sector and its role in those economic terms, that's the only way we can do it? We can't challenge it more broadly just because the forces are so entrenched?
So I think there's different aspects of that. So you're absolutely right. Of course, it's not just about setting big goals, but it's so incredible what you can do when you have a problem to be tackled, you know, instead of obsessing about, you know, sector or technology. And so I think one of the things that's powerful about the concept is it also allows us to transform our current institutions, which are often problematic. The reason industrial strategy hasn't worked often is because it really just ended up being handouts to sectors and firms that were just louder asking for money. Academics, by the way, we're very good also at asking for money, so we also can capture government policy. So actually, the work we did in Scotland, for example, was to work with Nicola Sturgeon about transforming their public bank, so that what it was about was lending out this patient strategic long-term finance to, again, any organization in the Scottish society, if you want, that was willing to engage with their inclusive growth strategy, their innovation-led kind of, you know, a green strategy, which just means that you are no longer just about, again, handouts and asking, you know, business what it needs, but setting sort of strong public goals. And that's the second point, which is even in countries where there has been kind of a mission-oriented organization in a particular area, say in health, the National Institutes of Health in the UK, sorry, US, which spend over $30 billion a year on financing that kind of high-risk part of the pharmaceutical industry's research, they themselves become captured, this is a public actor, because they have allowed the pharmaceutical industry to define this kind of market of health. So there's too much investment, I would argue, in research on drugs, medicines, too little on some other things which don't even sound that exciting, like diagnostics and surgical treatments, but much less on healthy living. And the real role, I think, of an ambitious public actor should be to be sort of a thorn in the side and to be stretching the boundary of even how we define that market. That's what I mean by market shaping and market co-creating. It's a redefinition of the market itself. But, you know, the last thing I want to say is the point about missions is people are quite depressed, right? I mean, I'm sure a lot of you, well, you all look a bit depressed because you're in the dark there. But I often find myself, I often say, I go to speak to, you know, countries and especially public servants worldwide, and I walk in as an economist and I walk out as a life coach, because so much of this language actually just makes you feel like that, right? So as soon as you start saying, hey, there's some big problems to solve, and what do you think those problems are? How can you also engage with the actors in your society to really define those problems and then go after them as an investor, as a co-creator? It kind of makes you feel good again. So in an era of populism and also of real disengagement and lack of public trust in these institutions, missions, if they're also, again, co-defined in that kind of way that I mentioned in the German society, it's been interesting how the Green Movement was central, can actually kind of make us all feel not just good, but also tackle these challenges together. But it's not easy. It's not just about, you know, setting a mission. It's about using it as a way to unpick the problematic current structures we have.
Right. Well, I want to ask you about some of those countries in a moment, but Glyn, I'd forgotten about you and the 2020 summit. I suppose listening to Mariana, one of the things that's interesting to me is that we have sort of had a bit of a run of that in the Great Rudd era, and my argument would be, when Kevin Rudd was running for government in 2007, he was saying, let's build the NBN, let's put a computer in every classroom. Now, this was basically blasphemy. You know, this was talking about big public sector investment. Then he got in, the GFC hit. Australia had a very different role to everybody else in terms of, you know, putting all that upfront investment, for which it was castigated and criticised. But I suppose, based on what Mariana's talking about, I'm interested in your reflections on why that didn't work in an institutional sense. You know, was it because of what Mariana talks about, that the public sector wasn't up to it, or was it because the forces reined against that change of thinking were too great, including, I would say, the media?
Yeah, indeed. Can I just start by echoing, I thought it was a fabulous lecture. Thank you. It's just wonderful to hear you. And a wonderful book. The Value of Everything is any economist who can start by picking up an Oscar Wilde quote and using it as doing really well, and it just gets better from there. And to sustain chapters about the definition of value under Adam Smith, under David Ricardo, and under Karl Marx. This is a formidable intellectual achievement.
Thank you.
So, well done. It's just a great read. I think there are four things, and I'm sorry to be boring and have a list, one social, one economic, one technology, and one existential, that explain why we didn't go anywhere. The social one is actually the long-term decline of social capital, which has been long discussed. In the Australian context, that's meant the atrophication of political parties, so that what's left are the apparatchiks and the hacks and the people for whom this is a career, and that ability to then knock off leaders and the instability that's brought on is because there's no ballast in the process anymore. And so we've actually suffered, I think, a real price from that. The economic one is described very well in the book. It's the forces that got us to the marketisation of everything and then the global financial crisis that arose. Mariana's book has an exquisite explanation about how finance became central to our economy and how it moved from unproductive to productive in all sorts of ways. And that has been really important, but it left us highly vulnerable in lots of ways. The third is the technology one, and that is all of our platforms for public conversation largely vanished almost overnight. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but we didn't replace them. We don't have other things. All we've got is this giant comments page called Twitter. And so we don't have that discussion anymore. So you can't address the first two because there's no forum to do it. And the fourth, Mariana has also touched on, is the existential crisis. Climate change doesn't lend itself to politics as usual. It's managed in the last decade to rip aside both of the leading political parties in this country, which is quite extraordinary, and done it more than once. And we still can't arrive at a policy that makes sense for where, you know, the nature of the crisis and the existential nature. A democracy that faces a crisis like that, and they don't come along often, you know, is really tested in a way. We had those four things all come together all at once, and not surprisingly, we haven't done very well against any of them. I'm not surprised that a government elected on the eve of the GFC wasn't able to address them, but it was the same government that was then ripped apart by climate change, not by finance, only to see those that followed do exactly the same. This is a different moment for us, and it's not one that solves just by saying, you know, more democracy is better, and if only we had more, in the same way that Brexit has shown some underlying issues in Britain that aren't going to be fixed just by going back to process.
So if we look back at some of the countries that you've looked at in the sort of climate change prism, I'll be controversial here, is China actually the most successful country in addressing climate change, partly because it is basically still a centrally run economy? I mean, lots of different countries are doing things about climate change, but if you think about the country that has had the most dramatic impact on green energy, I'd just ask you whether, I mean, it seems to me that in a way the impact it's had on the price of solar power, for example, globally has been incredibly significant. Could you just maybe address the way some countries and that sort of role of the public sector has has worked to date in the last 10 years, though.
Sure. So China is spending $1.7 trillion in greening its economy. And that's not just about, well, that's renewable energy, so the solar example you gave, but also, you know, energy-friendly technologies. It's doing also what Germany's doing in terms of getting its entire manufacturing base to lower its material content. This happened in steel in Germany, which was very interesting. But, you know, huge amounts of money, but precisely because it's actually seen it as, you know, with extreme urgency, almost that kind of wartime scenario, because of this extreme pollution. You know, it's extraordinary, the amount of pollution. And so that's also interesting how, regardless of whether it's a democratic or not democratic society, when something happens that's really treated with urgency, like going to war, right? I mean, in democratic societies, when countries go to Afghanistan, Vietnam, or World War II, they don't say, oh, we don't have enough money. They just go. They find the money. And so what happens when you actually also frame some social or political or, you know, semi, you know, these tricky, or what are they called, wicked problems like climate change, but also inequality with urgency. It's interesting to remember Johnson talked about the war on poverty, or, you know, the war on cancer. If then that's framed, I think, in this mission-oriented lens, which require lots of different types of actors in the economy to fight that together and also to use government instruments to reward not just any actor, but those that are willing to, you know, take on these kind of high-risk investments, then you do get these big changes. In Denmark, you know, a tiny little country, it's small. I can't remember, but it's small. it has become the number one provider of high-tech green services to China's green economy. And that's not just because, you know, it devised some sort of, you know, carbon tax or tax credit or something. They really have had a green vision in the country, often at the city level, by the way. Cities and states around the world are often, I mean, you see this in the U.S. where New York City and the state of California are reacting against Trump's denial of climate change. But, you know, it's often been also missions around cities, a sustainable city. That then requires all sorts of services to make that happen so that the startup community isn't just kind of doing gadgets, but also servicing a transition of a city like Copenhagen. So what was interesting in Denmark is they ended up having the mission, but they also had the manufacturing power with companies like Vestas, you know, who also have benefited from the patient financial institutions in Denmark. Denmark, by the way, has also had something very important, which is an organization called Mind Lab inside the government, which really tried to help the civil servants to really kind of think out of the box and do that MBA-style, you know, welcoming exploration and experimentation that I was talking about before kind of facetiously. But, you know, it's China's interesting because of that urgency. China's interesting because it's learned from Silicon Valley in an area where Trump is unlearning it. Trump is the first U.S. president to really go after what I call the entrepreneurial state. The first thing he did in office was go after ARPA-E, which is the sister organization of DARPA, which came out with the internet, but in the Department of Energy. He wanted basically to abolish it. And, you know, he's smart. People make fun of Trump, but he is smart because if you want to destroy the state, you don't go after its budget. Budgets come and go, as you see. You know, Theresa May is spending, Trump is spending. You go after its institutional capacity. So, you know, the neoliberal project in its best form is when you go after the organizations. It's interesting also that Romney went after PBS and ARPA-E himself, which, you know, this isn't about saying good guy, bad guy, but, you know, also understanding how these organizations have been innovative and have been able to think out of the box is something that China, I think, has been studying sort of with a microscope. And someone once said to me, China's not necessarily yet the entrepreneurial state, but it's very much the adaptive state. It looks around and it tries to understand what works, what doesn't. Then, of course, there's the whole democratic issue, but that's not what we're talking about.
But I mean, the bottom line here is that people in China don't think the state's bad, I suppose. I mean, you were saying yesterday that, you know, there's still a meritocracy in China, that people value the state, you know, so it's not, they're not sort of having to sort of fight off the idea that whatever they're doing is bad in the first place. So, as you say, you've got, at the other end of the spectrum, you've got Trump destroying the institutions, but, you know, is a real reason for the success of China, whether it's in the green space or in the economy more broadly, just the fact that it actually thinks the state is a good thing.
Well, I mean, I think the future of China will be determined by all sorts of things, and it's not about sort of state, not state. It's how its state actually ends up evolving. So a decentralized network of different types of public actors has been very important in some countries to compete and to be, produce the kind of goods the world wants to buy. So currently they have large state institutions, including the China Development Bank, which has played a huge role in providing that patient long-term finance to its companies, both in the renewable energy sector, as well as companies like Huawei, which is in the news this week. By the way, Huawei, you know, most people don't realize it's a cooperative. It's like John Lewis. and I was once in a Davos kind of setting with some of their leaders, and they said to me, how can we, you know, think about not so much marketing, but kind of getting the U.S. public to understand who we are, because, you know, they're just presented, this was about 7 years ago, they're presented Huawei as some, you know, spying agency trying to get hold of the telecoms of the world. And I said, tell them you're a cooperative. You know, it's just interesting that there's different ways to structure capitalist companies, and they don't have to be shareholder-driven. They also don't have to be completely state-owned. There is, you know, different types of governance structures, and that stakeholder governance structure, not shareholder one, especially in the co-op area, has historically actually been, in places like Italy, very powerful. And wouldn't it be interesting, actually, if China could, along some other developing countries that are sort of going up in the chain, also re-experiment with different types of governance structures? But the whole meritocracy thing is interesting. I mean, we've seen what happens in much of the Western world when you have the kind of Eatonite pathway to government and the kind of idiocy that then that you know produces and people like Boris Johnson. So this is, sorry, have to put that in there. But yeah, meritocracy is a good thing.
Yep. can I just add to that? It's why Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, is the most scary read of 2018, because he's talking about what happens when you run down the institutions of the state in a democracy, particularly when they're responsible for very long-term programs like looking after nuclear waste. You start cutting those agencies, and the consequences are way beyond the political cycle. It's a really important read, I think.
Well, Glenn, you're also involved in the 30 review, as Trev mentioned, and I don't want to obsess about the GFC, but I want to take up the point that Mariana makes about how when there's a war, we tend to galvanise our forces. And the thing that's sort of striking to me about what she says about the GFC is that suddenly we had this crisis, and it does usually, a really huge crisis usually does produce a reset in thinking, and it often produces a point of time where everybody looks to the government to fix things. Okay. And it sort of didn't really happen this time. I mean, I don't just mean in Australia, but the fact that the US interventions ended up being so so much of a schmozzle, as you say. I mean, why was it that there wasn't that reset in thinking? Why didn't we go, well, you know, just the financialisation of the system has been a real disaster. The banking system's almost brought us undone. We need to change the regulatory framework. I mean, what do you think happened there?
Without putting words in Mariana's mouth, her argument in the book is very much focused on the definition of value that we operate from, which actually doesn't give us any flexibility to rethink policy, because it ties value to a set of actors and outcomes and markets, and we didn't want to go there. I mean, the fundamental question about the banking system in 2009 was, without the state intervention, we'd have gone into deep depression and we'd have lost the banks. We didn't conclude, therefore, the banks should be in public ownership. We just concluded that we should look after them, and then with very little cost to them, in fact, very little indeed, allow them to go back to the way they were. And the point about our Royal Commission now is it's showing how little change we had. I'm agreeing with you in the 10 years. So Mariana's trying to argue that, or is arguing that, the value, the way we define and understand value is the essential change we have to make in order to change the policy settings. That's an incredibly ambitious argument. Some of the reviews of the book, I'm thinking of Martin Wolf's review or Howard Davies, have sort of said, well, I like the analysis, but I can't see there's another way of thinking about value except price. And it's they call it a distinction without a difference. And if we can't separate these things, it doesn't have a policy path that comes off it, which is presumably the criticism that you've been listening to and responding to.
Because I suppose this is my point, though. If there was going to be a time when we sort of did sort of think, wait a minute, this is all wrong, shouldn't it have been at the GFC? You know, if we were going to say, wait a minute, something has gone profoundly wrong here, you know, we have to really rethink these things. I understand what you've said about all of these things, but I still don't quite understand why that didn't seem to happen, why we didn't have more of a breakthrough moment then.
Right. So first, it's important to also quantify just how little has changed. So, you know, one of the things that caused the crisis was this very high level of private debt, not public debt. It's amazing how much of the world then focused on reducing deficits in reaction to it. But it was the private debt that got completely out of control. And today, private debt to disposable income globally is back at record levels as it was just before the crisis. So in both the US and the UK, which were the kind of epicenters in terms of the banking system, which then fuels itself by this kind of high amount of public debt, it's very interesting. But then you have to ask yourself, why is there all this private debt? I mean, if real wages aren't increasing, as they haven't been increasing since the 1980s in many countries, you know, many citizens actually had to take out debt just to retain their existing living standards. So in terms of why, you know, what have been the bottlenecks and the impediments to actually get real wages to increase, you know, there you'd have to look at bargaining power, again, of trade unions, as I mentioned before, which historically have, of course, been very important, but also this kind of lack of reinvestment back into production, which includes into the workforce itself. Skills don't just come from government training programs. They also come as endogenous effects of the investment cycle itself. So when we have this falling amount of government investment, workers obviously aren't benefiting. We haven't somehow gotten our acts together. Again, if we can get to the moon, why couldn't we get a financial transaction tax? That wasn't a very hard thing to do. It's incredible that there isn't a global financial transaction tax. And of course it has to be global, it can't be one country. And you know, this whole issue of these financial institutions, you know, when RBS and other types of banks became publicly owned, why not really transform them and use them in this kind of, you know, mission-oriented way to tackle publicly set goals instead of just kind of quickly restructuring them and selling them off again? And by the way, the huge amount, the trillions that were plugged into the system through quantitative easing just ended up back in the banks, right? Because it wasn't accompanied by also a creation of opportunities for that investment. And that's, you know, part of the story is it's not just the bank's fault. If there aren't opportunities to invest in, then where did we think that money was going to go? And so there wasn't an ambitious fiscal policy. And in fact, in Europe, it was a real deformation of the word fiscal compact. It was basically just how much not to spend. This kind of voodoo number of 3%, you know, you can't have, well, now it's like zero, everyone wants a surplus, but this idea that you can't have over 3% of a deficit, otherwise all hell is going to break loose, was just a complete fallacy. Italy, my country, has had a low deficit for years. It's never had a high deficit. It's always had a lower deficit than Germany. But because the public and private sector were equally problematic and not investing and not long-termist and not also structuring themselves properly, debt to GDP rose and could, in fact, rise to infinite level if the denominator is not growing. So if you're not investing through the different sectors in terms of long-run productivity drivers, long-term growth drivers, then debt to GDP can get very high, even with a mild deficit. Just that basic distinction wasn't sort of rising in the media. I mean, I often go on Newsnight, and I often said to Evan Davis, come on, you keep repeating the stupid things. You know, oh, do you think labor should just run an infinite deficit? I'm like, you're not listening. That's not the problem. We obsessed with that number. And that's interesting, actually, with the Brexit debate, where some people, even some smart people like Larry Elliott, you know him, the journalist in The Guardian, he actually supported Brexit because he said the European Union has just completely lost its way and it forced austerity, et cetera. And part of that argument is right. I mean, Europe really, I think, obsessed with the wrong numbers and caused all sorts of problems because the diagnosis of why the pigs, I'm allowed to say that because I'm Italian, so Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, if a German calls those countries pigs, you know, you can't do that. It was a Goldman Sachs terrible term to refer to those countries. The diagnosis of why these countries were periphery and why the stronger countries were core was that the peripheral countries had sort of spent too much, which is like, no, they didn't. They had just spent really unwisely. They didn't have some of the institutional capacity that countries like Germany and the Scandinavian countries had. So public banks, Fraunhofer Institutes, vocational programs that were serious, the, you know, again, corporate governance structures of a certain type. So imagine the European Union as a learning institution, kind of what works, what doesn't, and instead of shoving down the throat to Greece, spend less, you know, just cut everything, say, hey, you can't be part of the union if you don't also have these really important research organizations that provide science-industry linkages, if you don't have patient finance, if you don't really train up your workers through well-devised vocational and apprenticeship programs and, you know, rethink your corporate governance structures. That would be a different type of European Union. But of course, by Brexiting, you're no longer part of the conversation. So that was a really kind of dumb thing to do. But it is true that Europe really should be taking this moment to rethink itself. And that does require also thinking about how value is created at the governance level. Because what we actually see in Europe today is a model that is actually going towards the American one.
Well, I just take you up on that. I mean, we hear about Brexit and England here in terms of what's happening in Europe, or the whole deficit sort of focus. But it strikes me that the sort of concept of the state is much stronger still in Europe than it is in Anglo-Saxon countries, and the sort of absolute dominance of markets is not as great. You know, I mean, you've talked about the fact that there is. In Germany, you know, these schemes, it's come out of green politics. In Scandinavia, you get a lot more investment. I'm just interested in your perspective on if you can group them.
Yeah.
There still seems to be more of a culture of the role of the state in Europe.
So Europe is very heterogeneous. In some European countries, yes. In many, I would say the majority of European countries, no. And the whole point of my entrepreneurial state book, which was don't believe the hype. The U.S. actually has a much stronger state than many European countries do. Americans talk Jefferson, but act Hamilton. And I'm not talking about the musical, even though you should see it. It's a fantastic musical if you can get tickets. But, you know, Hamilton being the kind of the proponent of state intervention in the history of the United States. Actually, on the innovation side, on the competitiveness side, the state in the US has been extremely active, strong, interventionist, and visible hand, not invisible hand. On the welfare state side, it's been a disaster. I mean, I don't know if you've been to San Francisco lately, but it's a crime, the amount of homeless people and sick people in the street. And many US cities and states should be embarrassed by, you know, the barbarism, really, that has been allowed by not having a proper welfare state. But unfortunately, many European countries are going that way. So that's my point. You know, we should, if we're going to talk about Europe, really have a reflection, what works, what doesn't. And the problem is that when you also have a distrust in the European sort of commission as this kind of higher level, and if you want state, precisely because some of the diagnosis has been wrong, so the remedies have just made the patient sicker, not better in terms of the weaker countries, there's also been this kind of, you know, distrust in the commission itself, at the national level. I mean, Germany, it's interesting what's happened with Merkel recently, you know, and also what happened when she was really defending also a progressive stance on immigration and the kind of backlash that she faced. But, you know, It's there is a way to reframe these problems. I mean, what's interesting on the innovation side, by the way, is that we think of it just as a technology thing, but imagine a public lab of the CERN type in Europe, but addressing immigration challenges. Why not? No, I'm serious. No. Immigration as a positive force. We know diverse opinions are important. We know that, you know, you could also use the satellite system to make sure that no one dies on the Mediterranean. So there would be also that sort of technological issue of just making zero. That's a good mission. Zero deaths in the Mediterranean. We can do it. We have the technology. But I'm thinking more about the social structures and the thinking between anthropologists, sociologists, poets, the humanities, being just as involved in thinking about this big challenge that so many countries have around immigration. I know Australia has a huge issue in terms of some abuses, no? And Christmas Island, and you know, let's throw our full capacity of knowledge in the 21st century at these problems, but in a way that really welcomes diverse thinking.
But don't we end up having these grand challenges always around technical issues because of the social divisions that make it difficult to have?
Yeah.
And there's our problem. How do we frame a grand challenge that goes to a direct social question like immigration and refugees, for example, that doesn't then play straight into the political divide here or in any country? And that's the problem Merkel encountered. She thought she had a national consensus and it evaporated the moment she acted.
Mm. Yeah.
Even though most people, I think, outside would think she acted with enormous humanity.
Can you imagine the poets getting together with the bureaucrats in Australia?
I'm trying to.
we can't even sort of say, oh, we need to have a population policy without the politicians running a million miles.
Without having that argument.
Yeah.
And so that's why we end up focused on technical solutions and why we go for very conventional ways of thinking we can encourage the economy through stimulating R&D and the other parts of it instead of having a broader conversation, as the book argues, for around what might you do to focus public investment in areas where you wanted to make a difference, which is precisely what we don't do.
Yeah.
One of the issues that's come up a lot in the current review of the APS, and I'm not speaking for that review, but given we're here in the name of John Menadue, one of Australia's great public sector leaders, is that and Mariana picks on this in her book, the new public management of the 80s and 90s has seen us transfer enormous capability from public to private. We've contracted out an enormous amount. You've touched on this in your book on political amnesia.
Yeah.
One of the CDP studies suggests, and I apologise, Travis, if I got the number wrong, that $1.7 billion of public money has been spent in the last 5 years on the big four accounting firms, basically transferring out money so that they would do tasks once done inside. One of the consequences of that is the huge loss of capability and capacity inside the public sector, because I'm sure KPMG do a fine job, but it doesn't stay in the state. And so you lose constantly that intellectual capital. And it's a consequence of changes that didn't set out to do that, but have had that. You discuss that in Political Amnesia. Mariana gives an intellectual history for back through economic thinking, back to public choice. But one of the questions we have to frame for ourselves is, are we comfortable with that if we are going to principally rely on outsourcing of public services and policy making? How are we going to capture the lessons and play them back into the policy process? Because that's the big risk. You will never get the integrated response to a major problem if you haven't got all of the players able to come around the table and have the conversation, discuss what's possible. And the more we fragment the state, the less we can do that.
Brexit, by the way, is being run by four consulting companies. No, I'm serious.
And so well,
Do you know Trafalgar Square has four plinths? No, there's a fourth plinth that can change. Some artist is chosen every now and then to that four statue. I wanted to suggest that they do a clock, you know, like in Times Square, there's the deficit clock, you know, how much the U.S. government is spending. And I thought, let's have a clock on the Brexit spent, direct, not indirect. That would require modeling of the future job losses, which everyone would debate, but just how much we're spending on Brexit. And a big chunk of that is the day rates of PricewaterhouseCoopers. Yes, Martin. you know, KPMG, Deloitte, et cetera, just because the, you know, partly it's a huge challenge, forget whether it's right or wrong, and at the same time the civil service actually has been decimated. The first thing that David Cameron said in the first month in office, 2010, was civil servants are the enemies of enterprise. And if I can quote Malcolm X, you know, the chickens have come home to roost. You know, you now got a problem, you got the biggest, you know, management complex problem to manage, and they're not able to do it. And not because they're stupid, but they've literally, you know, both in terms of numbers, in terms of salaries of the civil service, and in terms of the lack of capabilities, which has become, again, a natural consequence of thinking that you're not value creating. Why should you be investing in that? And outsource, and Jeremy Corbyn, by the way, has really failed not only to provide an opposition to Brexit, which, you know, he's going to go down in the history books as not very well, alongside the ones who voted, you know, who kind of actively engineered Brexit, but also he keeps reframing things in this old way of privatizing or nationalizing, which actually then dismisses this much more subtle point that you're making, which is it's not really just about whether the rail system is public or private, but how could it be that they allowed Richard Branson and others to come in and to get a piece of the pie with no conditions attached? Mm. So if you have a strong public sector, you could say, okay, this is the kind of rail transport system that we want. We want it to be modern, green, fast, et cetera. And so yes, come in, but that means you have to invest, you have to maintain it, you have to make it sustainable. And the lack of that is the problem, and that's due to this lack of confidence, but also literally at the contract level, there was no conditions attached. And similarly, these PFI schemes, the private financing initiatives in the health area, were a complete disaster because they also allowed the private sector to come in and actually direct the show. It wasn't mission-oriented. What was the actual mission? What kind of healthcare system did the state want to create? If that was really clearly delineated, then you could have some private providers for bits of it, but not to actually transform it in the process because they just made it a profit-making opportunity.
And you tell the story of the water authorities in the UK, the five water authorities, and the privatisation of those and the consequences now being felt. Mm. So it's a one-off fantastic hit for the budget on long-term cost, and that wasn't factored into the sale price.
Yeah, and the post office too.
Yeah. And even when you're not privatising things, you've got the National Disability Insurance Scheme in Australia, which is, you know, brand new institutional structure, and it's already being designed to work around large health organisations. They're already shaping it. So I have to add, Britain's been poaching all of our trade negotiators because they didn't have any. So it's another sort of source of institutional loss. We're almost out of time. Once again, I'm just sort of interested, Glenn, just bringing this back home. How optimistic are you that we can actually rebuild some of that capacity in the public sector? I mean, you've not reflecting on what the review is going to say, but having listened to all of this, is it as simple as not outsourcing?
That doesn't go. You can't go back. You can never recreate. Mm. We're never going to renationalise. We're never going to...
Maybe not contracting out or whatever.
But we're going to have to say this hasn't worked. Mm. In a sense, we've taken the model as far as it can go. We now have whatever advantages it's delivered we've got. We've now got all the prices. So we're going to have to rethink. I don't think the answer is to say, therefore, you don't contract. I think the answer is to say, what is our sophistication in contracting, in specifying the price, in thinking the long-term value, and in sharing both risk and return between public and private? I'm entirely sympathetic to the program that's in the book because that's essentially where it goes. It just requires a whole lot more policy work than we've put into it. It requires expertise we probably don't have. And it provides... So we need a way of encouraging our best and brightest young people to do what they did in John Menadue's generation. They went and worked for the Commonwealth. They cared about national government. They wanted to go to Canberra. They wanted to be part of this conversation. If all the work is done by consulting firms, it's really hard to persuade a new graduate that their future is in the public service and not in KPMG. Thinking about the consequences of our choices and how we can rebalance seems to me the answer.
But why should any young, bright person want to work in the civil service if the way these institutions are then structured is, again, so boringly, right? So I often give the example of Steve Chu, who is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who decided that he wanted to leave Stanford and go direct the Department of Energy in the US under Obama, not because he just thought it was interesting, but because Obama very explicitly said that the remit of the DOE around 2009 would be to help direct the stimulus program. It had a real mission. This was before the Tea Party sort of ended up bringing in the whole sequestration problem. But, it was an honor for him to direct an institution that was going to have such a bold remit. So the real question is, how can we rethink the remit? Yeah. And this was the whole issue around the BBC, that they have sort of resisted the remit of just kind of fixing some public good problem with, some high quality, documentaries, but not actually being bold in terms of, the public value, even through the soap opera. So these kinds of discussions of how can you have not just the missions in terms of these, addressing the SDGs and climate change, but literally mission-oriented organization that sees its role in terms of transforming a landscape, not just facilitating it, Because if you're a really bright physicist, are you going to want to go work for an agency that wants to de-risk Elon Musk, or at best do a carbon tax, or do you want to go work in an agency that's about really kind of investing in a serious green transition, which is going to, you know, transform Australia? The latter obviously is going to attract really bright people, and they're going to want to go join the civil service. So how to really change these structures, and that's what we're trying to do in this institute. We're trying to both create a new curriculum, where we have four funky courses that hopefully will also make civil servants hungry and foolish, but also literally we've set up a platform for 30 different global organizations that we've identified as having tried, from ones in Singapore, Dubai, the US and Brazil, have tried to step outside of this market failure fixing box to also share their experiences one with the other. And one of the key experiences is, how are you currently evaluated by your treasury? You know, if you are evaluated based on cost benefit and net present value, it'll be extremely hard, no matter how much you'd like to have these kind of bold ambitions. So what needs to then replace what in the UK we call the Green Book, which is the way that the Treasury evaluates public investment, we actually need to see that through. What will be a different tool, literally the practical tools that could be available. And we'd love, by the way, for some Australian organizations to join this network. So I've been talking to CPD to help us identify. So the CEFC, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, is very interesting. We met with them today.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Please thank our panelists.
Thank you.